You're listening to the Mushroom Revival podcast. What's going on, guys? Some of you may have noticed that we've been not posting as regularly as we used to. We used to publish an episode every week on the week, and the last few weeks we've been kind of doing it every other week. So we've been incredibly busy. Life is sometimes a little chaotic, but we've been trying our hardest to get these episodes out so your hungry ears can devour this fungal information. So thanks for being patient. I know we've been getting messages of people like, where's the next episode? So thank you for being patient. We got you. We will continue these episodes coming on a cadence. So we are talking about fire and fungi today. This was such an enlightening conversation, really shifted my perspective on fungal diversity and fungal ecology and forest fires as a whole. If you want to support the show and you love what you're listening to, we don't take any third-party ads. We don't have a Patreon. We don't have a way for people to donate to support the show. We put in a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and time and energy into making this content for y'all. So how you can do it is just word of mouth is number one, telling all your friends and family to tune in, to leave a review, and to share on your social media. And speaking of reviews, we actually pick one review a week to show off to the rest of the world your fungal love that you're sharing with us. And actually, the review of the week is from Lee Corvus, and the subject is Best Fungal Podcast. The subject is being a student and lover of everything fungus. This podcast and its hosts bring incredibly valuable information, perspectives, and insights into the ever-growing field of mycology, bringing together specialists from all across the field to discuss, learn, and teach about their nuanced professions. With unfaltering passion, these two, in more ways than just their podcast, has helped me better understand complex fungal relationships, expanding my own mycelial network, as well as providing inspiration and guidance in my own mycological endeavors. Without a doubt, the best fungal podcast there is. Thank you, A and L. That was amazing. You know, sometimes we get really short reviews. Sometimes it's a long, beautiful poem like that was. But if you want to be featured, leave your best review and you might get lucky and we'll feature you on the show. Another way to support, we have a website, mushroomrevival.com. We have a whole line of functional mushroom products, from tinctures to capsules to powders, gummies coming super soon. They might be out when this episode is released. And if you want to use a discount code, it is PODTREAT. Just enter that thing at discount for a surprise discount. We won't tell you what it is. We change it all the time. So just plug in the code PODTREAT at checkout to get some fungal goodies. All right, the moment you've been all waiting for. Let's get into the show. I love this one. This is, you're going to love it too. Talking about fungi and fire.
Welcome, Monica Fisher. I found you via the New York Times article about fire-loving fungi. And, you know, I didn't know that there was a researcher out there with such specificity to their mycological niche. And I love it. I love that you're here. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So would you like to tell us about this mycological niche and how you ended up here? I mean, did you have a love for fungi? Was it ecology? And then how did you get in touch with the New York Times? How'd they find you?
These are all good questions. Yes, obsessed, in love with mycology and ecology broadly. I feel like there's sort of two avenues to being a scientist. One is your study organism and one is your question. And ideally, you're asking the best questions for your organism or your system, or like your system or organism is well suited to the questions that you're asking. I feel like I'm probably not alone in saying this, that fungi are a deal breaker for me. Mycologists tend to be a little, we're obsessed with fungi. But we also find questions that are well suited to being able to answer them in fungi and being able to understand how fungi are working, both internally within the fungus and then how the fungus is interacting in its world with other organisms, and that's ecology. So how did I get excited about post-fire fungi? Let's see. I guess so my project specifically started back in 2013, before I was ever on this project. I was a second year grad student at Berkeley in Louise Glass's lab working on fungal genetics and molecular biology, nothing to do with fire. But one of our close colleagues down the hall, Professor Tom Bruns, he's a classical ecologist, and he was part of a long-term monitoring project where they're just monitoring fungal diversity over time, over some huge geographic area. It might have been national, it might have been global, I don't remember that detail. But he had two sites that were right outside of Yosemite where they just go every couple of years just to see who's there to keep adding to this long-term monitoring data set. And in 2013, the Rim Fire burned through those plots, which is like an ecologist's dream. That's a natural experimental treatment, or like a Mother Nature created an experiment for us. Wow. Yeah, which is super, he got super lucky. So he has all of this data from before the fire. Now all they have to do is go sample the exact same sites post-fire, and they have this beautiful comparison of this is what this exact same piece of earth, what the fungal community looked like pre-fire and post-fire. And then they were able to track it for about a year and a half afterwards to see how the fungal community shifted over time. And so the way that they were doing this was by collecting soil and just sequencing all the DNA in the soil. And then they were also collecting any fruiting bodies that they saw coming up and bringing those back into the lab, identifying them, getting them into pure culture, and sending those off for genome sequencing. And so now we have this whole culture collection of living organisms in the lab that we also have reference genomes for that we can use to study how these organisms really do what they're doing in the lab. So that's really where, that was about where Tom's research stopped, and I picked up the torch and ran with it. Tom Bruns has since retired, but he's still around.
It is really funny how, you know, the general feeling that I've heard from most people with wildfires or forest fires, it's sad for most people and shocking and a lot of negative feelings. But for you, it's excitement. And like, oh, wow, this is when the organisms that I study come out, you know, and they thrive. And it's just, it's really funny when you're studying biology or ecology on these mass timescales of once you kind of dissolve the human perspective or ego, you know, things, yeah, good and bad just kind of falls away. And it is beautiful to like hear you getting really excited about these forest fires, right? During a time of like global weirding, where I know so many people that live in California and, you know, Oregon and, you know, are just like, oh, it's the worst. Like I have to move away. And here you are like, yes, this is great for my research, you know? And that's super cool. It's cool to hear, differing perspectives. And I'm just curious, like on the fungi's point of view, do you feel like they're adapting or do you feel like they're thriving?
I think they've already adapted and yes, they are thriving. But I just want to take a minute and like sort of appreciate, emphasize the darkness that you just brought up, that I feel like I've had to learn to kind of check myself, because yes, wildfire is a very real thing that happens that directly impacts a lot of people's lives. There is a very dark, heartbreaking side to fire, and to some extent, I feel like this is just ecology. Like, ecology is messy. I agree with you that there is no good and bad, but there's so much heartache that can be associated with wildfire that is very real, and I do like to acknowledge that and say, like, yes, I am bringing up a potentially traumatic topic that, like, I know people who have been really severely affected by wildfire, and it's really hard for them to understand how anyone could possibly get excited by anything related to wildfire, because it can be such a traumatic experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the lesson why I love fungi so much, is it takes a lot of this darkness and creates new life, right? I mean, it's like, we don't like to talk about death and decay and, you know, but it's out of compost that new life flourishes, right? Or out of the death of a wildfire, like, these new fire-adapted fungi are thriving, you know? And that's super cool to talk about the full yin-yang aspects of life, where it is an ecosystem and there's organisms that thrive in every single environment, you know, and, like, where death happens, life emerges. And I feel like the conversation around fire has just been mainly focused on the death part, right? Or the quote unquote bad part. But it's great to have this conversation to focus on, okay, what quote unquote good is coming out of this? And, you know, there are actually organisms that freaking love it. Yeah, and they, like, are waiting for that fire, right? Seeds and these fungi are, like, waiting for those high temperatures to emerge and thrive. So, yeah, I'm excited about this conversation.
Yeah, totally. And a lot of organisms need it. Like, there's a lot of research on how several plant species really need fire, right, to keep their plant communities healthy and vibrant and I don't know, quote unquote, like, tidy, and for their seeds to germinate. And we're starting to learn that some fungi have very similar adaptations.
Maybe you don't have the answer, but I've heard from a lot of forest ecologists, specialists, that, you know, forest fires are good. It's just the frequency of them. And right now, you know, we're having infrequent major fires, and that's when it's more problematic to more ecosystems and structures that humans create, is when the fires are very infrequent, but when they happen, they're huge, rather than more frequent, smaller fires. Do you have any data to on the effects of, you know, two fungi on less frequent, bigger fires as opposed to more frequent, smaller fires?
Ooh, yeah. So this was one of the big questions that really irked me really early on when I first started working on this. And pretty much the only data we had was from the Rim Fire. And I was initially starting to take all of those isolates that we had in the lab, and I was going to study them in the lab. But I was like, ooh, how representative is this of fire in general? Like, do fungi have different responses to different fire intensity, different plant ecosystems? Like, basically, was the Rim Fire a fluke or not? And when I started on this line of research in 2018, I did, like, dive into the literature, and I was cruising around on iNaturalist and, like, Googling every corner of the internet trying to find what people knew about post-fire fungi, and there wasn't much, which was really surprising to me. And I actually wonder if some of that is because people just sort of had this perception of everything dying, and there's, like, right, why go look? Because we know there's nothing there. A fire just obliterated everything. But also, like, fires have been fewer and far between and kind of deep in the backcountry, and it can be really logistically complicated and dangerous to go out to recently burned areas. But 2020 happened. Many things happened in 2020, but we had that totally bananas lightning storm. You guys are not in California, right?
No, we're in Austin, Texas.
Awesome. Okay, so I don't know if you heard about this. I think if anybody living in California will remember this forever. we don't normally really get any lightning here, but we had this wild, dry lightning storm all across Northern California in the driest month of the year. It ignited a mind-boggling number of fires. A lot of fires very close to the Bay Area, which, speaking of heartbreak, literal lung ache from inhaling smoke. Like, while the fires were burning, it was pretty traumatic. It was really rough. But then once the rain came, basically as soon as the rain came, and Cal Fire declared that some of the burned areas were safe to go into, there were a whole bunch of different fires very close to where I lived. And so it was really easy for me to go out about once a month, every month. We were already involved in some prescribed burns, which are like intentional, controlled, low-intensity burns up in the Sierra Nevada near Lake Tahoe, which is very similar ecosystem to where the Rim Fire happened. So we had a controlled burn that we had done in 2020. I had several wildfires that happened very close to where I lived also in 2020. And so I just started going out about once a month, every month to go see what was happening in all of these different ecosystems that experienced very different levels of fire. I just said this, but yeah, they're very different ecosystems. One site that I was visiting is sort of a coastal oak forest, also lots of bay laurel, the California bay leaves, which are tasty in soup. and then there's our like classic lush redwood forests. Just east of here is a lot of cattle rangeland that's mostly grass and some very scattered oak trees that gets very hot and dry most of the year. And then our prescribed burn in like a classic Sierra Nevada mountain pine forest. That was a much lower intensity burn. But in all of those areas, I saw the same fungi coming up, and they're just like so bright and colorful and cheerful and coming up all over the place at the same times too. I think it has more to do with the rain, like when precipitation started. As soon as there's enough moisture for them to grow, they do it. They go for it. But it was really incredible to see the same fungi coming up after different intensities of fires in very different ecosystems. So yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I've only heard of morels, and that's been a thing since I first started getting into mushrooms of look and in a place that just had a fire like the previous year, if you're looking for morels. And actually the first morel I've ever found, I was on the border of Nevada by Lake Tahoe, and I was searching, and it was like way past season, and everyone who knew morels was like, yeah, you're about a month late, you're not gonna find any, you know. And I was determined, and I would go out every day for weeks, and I would try to keep going higher and higher elevation, different ecosystems, whatever, wasn't finding anything. The last day I went to a burn site, and I'm looking around, the sun is starting to set. I'm like, okay, I'm never going to find it. I give up. There's a Renaissance fair right across the road from this burn site. I'm like, okay, I'll sneak into this Renaissance fair because it just had a major fence around it and no one was paying attention. So I hop the fence and I land from hopping the fence right on a morel. And it was just a single morel. No, like right in between my feet. I didn't step on it. And that was just the one morel I found, and right next to a burn site. So yeah, I'm curious, besides morels, what other mushrooms were you finding, or what other fungi?
Yeah, so many adorable little pink and orange cups.
Nice.
Yeah, it's interesting that the sort of series of fungi that tend to come up after fires, it it almost follows the phylogenetic tree. So it starts out with these like really small little orange and pink and sometimes brown cups. There's also a purple Pisiza that I was nice. new to me last year, Pisiza violacea or Geocypha violacea, it might be called. Yeah, there's so much color, and I feel like it sort of echoes the color of fire in this really wonderful way. They have these like orange and pink and red and purple cups. And yeah, so that's Pyronema, Anthocobia. Anthocobia is a prolific fruiter. If you go out to an area right after it's burned, before morels come up, you'll likely see these like carpets of Anthocobia that are just, it's like a orange 70s shag rug almost, except they're like little tiny cups. It's not hairy.
Wow.
Yeah. And yeah, then a little bit later, you start getting morels, which are also an ascomycete. So if you think about all the little pits in the quote unquote cap of a morel, you can think of like each one of those like a cup. And so it's just like lots of little cups stuck together. So all ascomycete fruiting bodies are just a modified cup. Yeah, so you have your sort of like bowl-shaped cups, then you get your morels, and then a little bit later you start getting basidiomycetes, like Laophyllum, Crassisporium. There's a Foliota that's fire-associated.
Do you know do you have any data on why these things are fruiting in the order that they are?
Yeah, that's one of the questions I'm trying to answer now. And that's a great question. I think, so some of it might just be growth rate, that Pyronema and Anthocobia grow really fast, and so that's part of how they get there first, whereas the Basidiomycetes grow slower, and so that's why we see them later. But there might be some sort of dynamic going on where like Pyronema might be breaking down some nutrient source that a later fungus needs to eat, the breakdown product from Pyronema, or maybe Anthocobia is producing a bunch of stuff that's sort of inhibiting the growth of other fungi and they have to overcome that, or yeah, it could be any number of things. We're actually in the middle of a giant experiment in the lab right now with all of those isolates from the rim fire, basically testing like all possible combinations of growing them in a sort of simulated succession on a charcoal medium.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so stay tuned. That'll be hopefully paper coming out.
Cool. Well, I don't know if you're far enough along yet, but my thought process coming from studying micromediation for so many years was just like the amount of enzymes that they're producing is probably wildly different from in other environments. I'm guessing this is chock full of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons from like half combusted, you know, carbon. So, I'm sure it's like really toxic for most organisms, but as we know, fungi are just really adaptable and resilient. So I'm just curious if you know anything about, like, are they expressing new enzymes that we haven't seen them express yet? Are they, and that was kind of my first question, are they thriving? Like, do they grow faster in this environment compared to a non-burn? Or are they just kind of like, oh, I don't have much competition, I'll grow here just because I'm an organism and I want to survive. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would say they're thriving given the circumstances. Like they're thriving because nothing else is able to thrive in that environment. But if you give them like a buffet of sucrose and everything they could possibly want.
Yeah. They'll pick that, yeah, over charcoal.
Exactly. and I think that's some of what makes these fungi really cool, is that they are sort of able to use whatever is available and, like, make do.
Do you know if they can use charcoal solely as a medium to grow?
Yeah, so that's the paper that got picked up by the New York Times, was all about how Pyronema is able to grow on pure charcoal and essentially nothing else.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, so we initially did an RNA-seq experiment to see which genes were being turned on in response to growing on charcoal. And we, to get back to your question about enzymes, we did find this whole suite of cytochrome P450s, which are usually involved in that like initial attack of an aromatic compound. That's the like really strong ring structure that's takes a lot of chemical energy to break that bond. So organisms tend to not like to do that, but Pyronema has several genes that can do that. It also really strongly turned on all the genes it would need to incorporate aromatic compounds back into central metabolism. And then we also did a stable isotope experiment to show that it is actually converting stable isotope tagged charcoal into CO2.
So does this fungus have genes that most other fungi don't? Is that kind of what you're seeing with its opportunistic properties? Or like, what else might be going on here?
Yeah, that is a great question that we have a little bit of. Well, okay, actually, we have a ton of data because we have genomes for all of these organisms and for all the fungi that Tom's lab collected after the RIM fire. We also have genomes for other fungi. And so some of our collaborators at the Joint Genome Institute, which is associated with Berkeley, it's part of the Lawrence Berkeley National Labs. Our collaborators there are doing a big comparative genomic study to answer that question. And I don't have a clear answer for you right now. My feeling is that they don't have different enzymes. There isn't like some, I think it'd be highly unlikely if we're going to discover some novel enzyme that nobody's ever heard of before. But it might just be that they have more of them, or maybe they have a couple enzymes that are very similar to enzymes that we already know a lot about, like these cytochrome P450s. But it might just, it might be using it to attack a different compound or something.
And we were just talking about how some plants, their seeds need fire indirectly or directly to germinate, which is insane and crazy and a great backup plan when fires do happen. Have you tried a test of trying to light these spores on fire or something like that to see if they germinate?
Oh, yeah. No, totally. This is, so actually the fungus that I did my PhD on, Neurospora crassa, that's like, it's like the lab rat of fungi. It's used as a genetic and molecular model, but it's actually a post-fire fungus. And the way that we germinate its spores in lab is either by heating them to 65 degrees C, which I think is about 150 Fahrenheit, or you can just plate them with a little bit of liquid smoke, like that you...
What?
Yeah.
Sick.
Wait. So it's not the heat.
Liquid smoke. Like if you go to the grocery store and you want to make a really cheap and quick barbecue sauce and you buy the liquid smoke.
That's
so weird.
Prompts germination of Neurospora?
Yes.
Well, there's no temperature fluctuation. So what's happening? This is so
like
interesting.
The PAHs are triggering it?
Yeah, that's weird. This is a great question. I would love to know. This is on my long list of scientific mysteries I would love to be able to answer in the course of my career.
To figure it out, you're coming on for an update.
Yeah, and it's interesting that heat alone will do it too. So we don't know if that's two different mechanisms. Like it will respond to heat or a chemical input, or is something about the heat triggering a chemical transformation in the spore coat, and that's the same chemical that's in liquid smoke. I don't know.
So do you make like a liquid smoke agar?
No, you just pour a little liquid smoke. We actually pour it in the lid of the agar plate. So it sort of like aerosolizes in the plate with the spores.
Wow, I love it. I love that whoever was just like, you know what, I'm going to go to the grocery store, buy some of this liquid smoke, try it.
And I'm guessing you've tried this with other species and they haven't worked. And then for whatever reason, just this handful of, you know, was it Paziza? Is that how you pronounce it?
The one that germinates, the spores germinate in response to smoke.
That one, or just all the species that you found and worked with, I'm guessing, obviously, because a certain amount thrives in this environment and other species that are normally growing in this environment don't. Any ideas why, or is this also the big mystery?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was, okay, so there's this big question in ecology of like, is everything everywhere, or is there biogeography?
Yeah.
And I think it depends on the organisms. I mean, I think it's, everything can't be everywhere. That just seems a little silly to me. But it is really interesting how these same fungi, at least Pyronema for sure, seems to really... Pyronema and Anthracobia actually and Neurospora come up after fires in very different ecosystems all over the world. And so they might just be waiting for a fire to come in and kill off everything else that can't survive. And then it's really good at taking over for a very short period of time right after the fire.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you ever see these species fruit in environments where there has been no evidence of a fire in many, many years?
So I guess this also gets at what does it mean to be pyrophilous? And so I like to think of sort of a gradient, perhaps, where there's like truly pyrophilous things that we never see outside of a fire. And that's like Pyronema, Anthracobia, some species of Neurospora. So there are some species of Neurospora that it's a bread mold also. Sometimes you can find it on coffee grounds in your compost, or maybe that's just me. Yeah, and then, right, so there's also morels, some species of morels that are only associated with fire, but there's Morcello rufo brunia that will grow on wood chips regardless of a fire. It's not as delicious, but... and then there are fire-tolerant things, so things that you might see coming up after a fire that are mixed in with all of what I would say are truly pyrophilous fungi, but they're just sort of, they were just fire tolerant enough, or maybe they were deep enough in the soil or something happened. They were able to get by and survive the fire that time. Or maybe they're always fire tolerant, but then they don't really survive well in post-fire environments, or you see them consistently outside of post-fire environments. They might be really, truly generalists that'll live really anywhere. So yeah, like Scutellinia, there's actually, so Pyronematacea is the family that Pyronema and Anthracobia are in, and there's a couple other genera. Like Scutellinia is the classic eyelash cup that has really long hairs. That one could be considered a fire tolerant one that might come up in some areas after fire, but it also comes up everywhere without fire.
So I'm curious about what a forest, how it would recover from this if these fungi weren't present. And maybe there's never been a case of this. Probably have to be a really epic fire to like completely wipe them out. But do you think that these fungi are helping the recovery by breaking down these pH heavy materials to open it back up to other microbes and things? And how much of that is being facilitated by fungi?
Yeah, I think fungi, this is my personal feeling, is that fungi play an important role in these really early post-fire ecosystems to sort of liberate a lot of nutrients from this pile of charcoal and ash that's otherwise very inhospitable to organisms that are going to come later, and fungi can help sort of make it more hospitable to more organisms. And my favorite hypothesis for what Pyronema is doing, because it grows really quickly, it's in super high abundance immediately after the fire. We've shown it can break down pyrolyzed organic material. There's like really complicated pH structures that are really prevalent in post-fire soil. But then it disappears really quickly. And so I love the hypothesis that Pyronema is basically like gifting its body, its biomass to the organisms that come after it. And it grows really quickly. It creates a lot of itself and then it dies. But all of that biomass that's left, its body essentially, is really easy food for any organism that's going to come after it. And so that can help. That's actually there are two things that I think are interesting about that. One, it can help feed the next iteration of organisms. And two, it might help with erosion, because if you think of the mycelial network, it can help serve to keep the soil aggregates in place. Assuming the rain isn't like too torrential or anything. There's a paper that came out recently showing that, I think it was Pyronema, that does like help aggregate soil.
So cool.
It has me thinking, because when I was studying micromediation, one of the ways in which large-scale industrial projects, they'll immobilize enzymes, which, you know, for listeners who don't know what that means, the enzymes are basically the stomach juices that fungi excrete out to break down toxic things. But they're really susceptible to pH changes or temperature changes, so they'll break down and become basically inactive. So you need to immobilize it, so protect them from those temperature, pH, etc. changes. And one of the methods is in carbon nanotubes. Now, charcoal is not that, but it's somewhat close. It's not on the nano scale, but there are, a lot of small tubes in there, and it's carbon-based. And so for a while, I was like, yeah, that's kind of like a myco biochar, you know, one could potentially use, you know, charcoal with fungal enzymes in it as a great kind of more grassroots way to remediate a site. And this is seeming like it's already happening, in these post-fire situations. And it seems like these fungi are kind of using charcoal as a home base and maybe even helping drill more holes in the charcoal, so more bacteria can go in there and really create, you know, the foundations of a cleanup and create more life. So yeah, this is super cool. I'm interested in what's going on inside the bits of charcoal. And I don't know if you have any studies or future plans to kind of investigate what's going on in the inside.
Oh yeah, that's a great question. This is in my list of future plans. I've absolutely thought that there could be some cool bioremediation applications for this. Because a lot of the quote unquote toxic compounds that are the focus of bioremediation projects are also present in charcoal, but we think of charcoal as this natural thing that in some cases is actually a good thing, because it can function as a carbon sink, because it does persist in the environment for a long time. But some of it is obviously breaking down. I would love to find out what the bioremediation application of this research is going to be. I feel like there is one, but we're a bit of a ways off from it at the moment.
But it's cool that, you know, humans like to get involved, but usually everything is better when we don't. And it seems like it's already just fixing itself, right? And it's already like these systems are already in place, and humans don't actually need to do anything, which is the cool part, which is awesome. And, you know, it just puts it in perspective. And this is going back to kind of what I was asking. One of the first questions is like the infrequent versus frequent fires. It's like, it seems like in terms of fire ecology, everything is better when humans just kind of get out of the way, you know, and we tend to just mess everything up. So yeah, what impresses you the most? I'm sure you've spent many nights awake with your mind turning of all these different questions, and you've gone through all the rabbit holes of what fire fungi can do. What has been the most impressive aspect of fire fungi for you?
I think the most impressive thing is just how vibrant and like how many there are. I was shocked at how much life I found basically immediately after wildfires and also our prescribed burn. And they're just like bright and cheery and colorful too. And I'm a bit of a visual person. I really like the colors of post-fire fungi. And yeah, just how many there are, how well they're doing. There's all so much life in post-fire ecosystems, like very recently burned post-fire ecosystems, and just really want to communicate the beauty and the tenacity and the resilience in post-fire ecosystems, especially in the fungi that are often coming up before plants even come up. And they're just love and life in this landscape that we as humans have sort of marked as this destroyed, heartbreaking place. But there's so much beauty and life there too. So yeah, the yin and yang, as you said earlier.
It's like the first day of their new life post-fire, and it's a birth in many ways.
Yeah, I've had many visions on psychedelics of just kind of the world crashing and burning and all this stuff, and it's very heartbreaking. And then the light at the end of the tunnel is like, yeah, fungi will love it. They'll be there. We'll nuke each other. We'll do all this stuff, and they'll be at the end of the tunnel just like, yeah, I'll eat all that radioactive waste and all the stuff you leave behind. Like, everything will be fine for fungi. They'll stick around and they'll eat up all our dirty room when we leave.
Yeah.
I prefer to not leave a mess for them, but as long as the fungi win, I'm happy.
So this has been so interesting, and I know that you have a million and one questions in your department, but what do you think in the field is one of the more pressing questions? And what do you hope to see maybe in this fire adapting fungi, but also in mycology in general?
Yeah, I think getting at mechanisms of how are these organisms doing what they do. This is sort of the trajectory of microbial ecology in general. I feel like a lot of microbial ecology began as who is where. And now we know a lot about who is where, although we're kind of really just beginning to understand who is where in post-fire environments. But then the next question is what are they doing and how are they doing it? Which you really need, you need tools in order to do that. You need a manipulatable system in order to do that. In ecology, that can be really difficult. And so I feel like we've gotten really lucky in that we have this isolate collection that we can manipulate in the lab. And Tom Bruns actually also developed this method called a pyrocosm, so we can make like little mini forest fires in a bucket. Whoa. Just outside the lab. Yeah. So that we can really manipulate what is going on with the fire, what is going on with the organisms, what if we have each organism by itself, what if we put all the organisms together, and like what if we feed it different things, what if we feed it specific PAHs, what if we feed it charcoal at different temperatures, and then we can look at gene expression, and we have an LCMS in our lab, so we can start to get at the chemistry of what exactly is the chemical composition of charcoal and how is it being broken down? What is the compounds that are resulting from that? So, I mean, that's like That is a lot of open questions, but I think that's that's absolutely where we're all going, is trying to understand the how of how these organisms are doing what they're doing.
I'm sure it hasn't been an easy process, where every single door just opens and you can walk right through, and I'm sure it's been twisty turny, and I don't know, maybe your whole lab got contaminated, or you got lab results that messed with 2 years of research or whatever. But what has been kind of the hardest moment in your research? It's everything. You're waiting for that light at the end of the tunnel.
Honestly, like, this has been such a, like, a positive, awesome scientific journey for me.
Hell yeah.
Part of what it has been scary to some extent is realizing how little research there was to stand on. Like, there was not much that was really known about post-fire fungi, or even, like, Neurospora is the most well-studied filamentous fungus, but nobody has studied it in its ecological context. Like, we all use smoke and heat to germinate the spores, but nobody knows what that mechanism is. Yeah, I think it's totally crazy too, but I'm hoping that I can start to answer some of those questions one day.
Well, since it's all been good and a fun journey, let's go on the other side. And has there been one moment that has been the most exciting, or like a champagne popping day where, you know, you won an award or you finally got the results in or something like that, that's been the most exciting?
I feel like this Pyronema paper was surprising and exciting. And it started out as sort of a side project, and then it became a, like, well, I have nothing better to do, it's a pandemic project. And it just, like, we didn't really set out to do what we ended up doing. And it ended up being surprisingly easy and straightforward, which I feel like never happens. I had a rotation student, Grace Stark, which, when you're a first year PhD student here, you spend 10 weeks in 3 different labs to sort of, like, sample a couple different labs before you decide what's going to be your lab home for the next 5 years. And so Grace was doing a rotation in our lab with me on this project. And I sort of threw a whole bunch of stuff at her as, like, let's do an RNA-seq experiment. Like, let's just see what Pyronema is doing on char. And then, you know, this might be part of something bigger later. I thought that I was going to scale it up with, like, all the other post-fire fungi, and it was going to turn into this, like, epic paper with RNA-seq from multiple organisms. But then we got the RNA-seq results back in, I think, at the beginning of March 2020. And then we went into lockdown mid-March 2020. And I had this giant data set. It was like, well, might as well start analyzing it. And so Grace and I analyzed it together while we were in lockdown. And then we were still in lockdown. We were like, well, I guess we should start writing since we can't go into the lab. This was also when I was running around to all the burned sites nearby, which was really cool. And yeah, it was like a really straightforward paper to write of, like, oh, hey, look, all of the, like, it was really obvious that Pyronema was strongly turning on all of these genes that you would need to degrade polyaromatic hydrocarbon compounds, which I feel like that doesn't always happen with RNA-seq data. Sometimes you have to really filter things and apply some statistics to it and sort of, like, massage out what the strong trends are. But the data were just really obvious. And then we shared it with our collaborators, and they're like, oh, we have a whole stable isotope set up that we can use to like more directly test this, because RNA-seq is just telling you that the genes are expressed, but the genes are being transcribed, but is that RNA actually being translated into a protein? Are those proteins functional? Are they are they catalyzing the reactions that you expect them to catalyze? There's a lot of questions that RNA-seq does not answer that stable isotopes could. And so we sent Pyronema over to our collaborators in Wisconsin in Thea Whitman's lab and her grad student Naila Ziba and our postdoc Tim Berry ran this whole experiment to grow Pyronema on the C13 labeled charcoal and then collected CO2. And it was just like, yeah, there is C13 labeled CO2. Bam, that's it. Done.
Love it.
Yeah. So satisfying. Very, it was just, I guess it was elegant.
So last question. And I get really excited on these types of episodes where the topic is around mycology, but it's a specific niche that like no one is studying, but is unbelievably important and can potentially have huge impacts on the world. And it seems to be something that everyone kind of interacts with, but no one is talking about it, right? Like, everyone is talking about wildfires and mushrooms are becoming a thing, I guess, in my worldview, but maybe not in other people's. But I'm sure we have so many people listening that are from California or, you know, Oregon have personally dealt with wildfires and are obviously, because they're listening to this, interested in fungi. And I'm sure there's another group of people that fit that description and are looking to kind of make a career in mycology and maybe are looking to go to school and looking for, okay, what do I want to study with mycology? And potentially this episode is going to be inspiring for a few people on to change their path. So what piece of advice would you give those people that you wish someone told you when you were first starting out?
I love that. I feel like somebody may have told me this, but maybe not. This is definitely just in my nature, is to talk to everyone. Like, go find people doing the things that you're excited about, the things that you think you might want to do, and just talk to them. Get a sense for what their life is like and what are they actually doing. And like, feel free to reach out to me. You can shoot me an email or message me on Twitter if you're listening to this and excited about what I'm doing. I'm always happy to chat with people that are excited about this stuff and thinking about heading in an academic route or a mycology route. It's really hard to know what you want to do unless you sort of try it on a little bit or like get a sort of firsthand sense for what is that type of life going to be like for you. Like, get involved in your local mycological society, email professors or grad students that you're excited about their work at your local university. See if there's like any opportunity for you to get into their lab. Like, just reach out to people and see what happens. You might be surprised.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Well, I'll have links to all of that in the show notes for anybody who's interested and on how to follow your amazing work, your really original work, and all the press that's been featured and anything else that's awesome. Any papers or publications that you're excited about or that are relevant, let us know. Give them to us and we'll make a Google Drive.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much. This is really fun.
You're awesome.
You're awesome. I'm excited to listen to your guys' podcast more. This is awesome.
Hell yeah. Now, and you've definitely changed my perspective on ecology and forest fires. I will never look at a forest fire the same ever again, or any of the species that you mentioned. I actually found the purple, is it Pisiza?
Yeah, Pisiza violacea.
Yeah, I was just in Mexico, and I'm pretty sure we found that species, and tons of the Anthracobia, is that how you pronounce it? A lot of those, and a lot of Cucuyina too, which you didn't mention, but it looks very similar to the eyelash cup. Yeah, and like I kind of looked it over, but now I have a whole new appreciation and all of this. So I thank you. I appreciate it.
Were these all in burned areas in Mexico?
No, it's funny. I was just Googling it. I was like, fire in, you know, in Las Nubes, which was where we're at, trying to see if there was a fire. And I didn't see anything, or at least I didn't see any articles come up. But potentially, if I was seeing those species, yeah, it makes me wonder that I had to Google it because I was super curious if there was a fire.
That's really interesting. They're classically called fireplace fungi because they also fruit in like fireplaces and burn piles and campfire pits. Yeah.
Cool.
So so it doesn't have to be a wildfire or a big fire at all.
Fireplace. That's intense.
That's great.
Nice.
I mean, if somebody would just like burned their garbage in front of their house, you might get these post-fire fungi there.
No, yeah, there's another weekend activity for us.
That's so funny. Well, thank you so much again. You're awesome. And I'm really excited to release this episode and get everyone onto Fire Love and Fungi.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right, y'all. That wraps up another episode of the Mushroom Revival Podcast. We love each and every one of you. If you love what you listen to and maybe, you know, you want to check out the show notes, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or something like that, you can head over to our website. We have a podcast section where we show the whole transcript. We have show notes, links to maybe various things that we mentioned, videos, books, articles, things like that. You can check that out on our website. We also have a bunch of functional mushroom products that are super delicious, super good for you. Use the discount code PODTREAT for a surprise discount and spread the word, you know, sending a huge hug to wherever you are in the world listening to the show. We literally could not do this without you, and we do it for you. Without listeners, this would be kind of pointless. We still have fun on our end, but we really do it for you, and we're so happy that your ears love fungal wisdom as much as our ears do. So love you guys. Have an amazing rest of your day and rest of your life.